We welcome today Dr. Helen Caldicott, a pediatrician by profession. Dr. Caldicott gained international renown in the 70s and the 80s as a worker and a leader in the anti-nuclear movement. She is a former president of Physicians for Social Responsibility, an organization she is credited with resuscitating, helping to raise its membership from 10 individuals to over 11,000 members in just 2 years. Dr. Caldicott is also credited as a prime mover in the leadership of the grassroots anti-nuclear effort worldwide, said to have blossomed and to have gained power in part under her nurturance. She is the author of Nuclear Madness, What You Can Do, a book published in 1979, and of Missile Envy, published in 1985 and revised in 1986, both books published by Bantam. Over the last few years, Dr. Helen Caldicott has been on a sabbatical from the movement and from movements in particular in general. Recently, she has begun to speak again, and now on ecological topics. Dr. Caldicott, welcome to Sunday at Noon. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
I want to cover a range of subjects in the next hour, but I want to start with the work that occupied you for over 14 years. And its current state, I think, is my first question. Many people are saying that with what seems to be a détente between the West and the East, with fledgling democracies around the world, many of them breaking away from the Soviet bloc, arguments in our own country, in the United States, over the defense budget and whether it is severely inflated for the times and which should be pulled back, with all these and many other thoughts in mind, that the nuclear threat is no longer as great as it has been in past years, far reduced. Yet I understand I read in an article that you said that the nuclear threat may be greater than ever now. Do you feel that's true, and if so, why?
I do. The equipment is still in place. Not one bomb has been eliminated, despite the INF, which reduces missiles and not bombs, which get redeployed. The United States is still pumping out about 5 new hydrogen bombs per day. I don't know about the Soviet Union. The air and the space is all wired up with satellites and over-the-horizon radars and underwater sonars, and there are 60 to 65,000 hydrogen bombs still on the planet. The US and Soviet Union are still conducting provocative nuclear war exercises. The buttons are still on computer control, but the perception of danger has lowered. Therefore, as the technology is still in place and the danger is still the same, but the perception has lowered, the danger and risk is even greater.
Because of complacency.
Yeah. And you see, to have Gorbachev there who is doing wondrous things, but to have a man like Bush in the White House who's doing nothing, in the face of the fact that we have a man who could help to save the world and that we could in fact eliminate nuclear weapons bilaterally in 10 years, and for Bush to do nothing is, I think, one of the greatest evils of our time.
What should he do?
Well, he should be doing what Gorbachev almost got Reagan to do 3 years ago in Reykjavik, which was to agree to eliminate nuclear weapons bilaterally within 10 years.
Soon, up in the next, 10 weeks or so, the two are supposed to meet. How do you predict that will go?
I think that the United States is procrastinating. They are talking about how many cruise missiles they can have in the air and on the sea. Cruise missiles are unverifiable. They talk about nuclear-tipped cruise missiles when each contains a bomb 15 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb. They're not tipped, for God's sake. What a euphemism. It's like we had to destroy the village to save it. They are hugely grotesque bombs, and they are unverifiable from space. Therefore, you can't really have an arms control treaty with cruise missiles in place. Yet the US proceeds to deploy them, and they will not allow them to be eliminated from this or included in the START treaty. And they are procrastinating, so the START treaty, it seems, will not be signed. But we shouldn't be having START treaties. We should be eliminating nuclear weapons bilaterally in 10 years. The peace movement's gone so far. And instead of resting on their laurels now, what they should be doing is saying, right, now this is the final push. Mm-hmm. We get Bush to really represent 75% of Americans who have wanted for 6 years a nuclear freeze bilaterally, but really they probably want elimination of nuclear weapons bilaterally, seeing the Cold War is now over and their use or possession is purposeless anyway. And eliminate them bilaterally. That's what we should be doing. And to allow Bush to get away with inaction, procrastination, and I think wicked inaction is is just ridiculous, because how long will we have Gorbachev? How long will he be there for us to waltz on the world stage with him and actually to save the world?
Mm-hmm. What would you say, what do you say to people who say we have to have some sort of protection? As you say, a Gorbachev won't be around forever and maybe his replacement...
Nuclear weapons have never protected you. I mean, that's a ridiculous concept. It's not the Defense Department. Your country's never needed defense. You have a Coast Guard to defend your maritime borders, and you have the Immigration Department to defend your northern and southern borders, period. No one can ever invade the United States. But you have set up a situation bilaterally where you can be destroyed in half an hour because, as you led the nuclear arms race, Russia stupidly copied and followed, and so you've set up your own suicide in effect. And so, therefore, to eliminate that particular dangerous situation, you could now move to eliminate nuclear weapons bilaterally in that danger within 10 years. And why doesn't it happen when 75% of the population would actually support it? Well, why doesn't... I'll answer my own question. It's not rhetorical. It's because the military-industrial complex controls the Pentagon, controls the Congress, controls the White House, and you can hardly buy shares in a corporation now that isn't involved directly or indirectly in the military-industrial complex. So it is a war economy, and to change that, it can easily be changed if the will is there, but these corporations are making too much money. Like, they make 75% profit a year, some of them, by making weapons, whereas they make 15% profit by making civilian goods, so they can't afford not to do it. It's really socialism for the corporations using your tax dollars, and capitalism for all of you guys, where you don't have a free healthcare system, you don't have free education, and your tax dollars, 55% of them, are used to build bombs. I mean, the whole thing is ludicrous. There are more adjectives that could be used.
This is what you've talked about when you've talked about an iron triangle.
It's
the Pentagon in one corner, related industry businesses in the other, and then key committees of Congress. Is that right?
Yes, correct.
You believe that iron triangle is still strong in 1990?
Oh, absolutely. And the revolving door is the sort of incestuous relationship whereby generals retire at a young age with a total pension at 42 and move into huge corporate positions where, and they've feather-bedded their nests so that they've given these corporations good contracts so that when they leave the Pentagon they have their retirement funds, plus they have a position as director of, say, TRW or GE or whatever, and then they can even run from Congress from there, or congressmen go and work for corporations. I mean, the incestuousness and the criminality is beyond belief, and it's never investigated really by the press. I said to Ben Bradley at the Washington Post years ago, he said, well, aren't we covering this issue? And I said, Ben, you've hardly touched it. He said, well, we write about M1 tanks. And I said, Ben, you've hardly touched it. I said, what is happening makes the mafia look like Boy Scouts.
If all these people are making so much profit, no matter which end of the triangle they're in, what is to compel them to change?
Nothing, except if the people rise up and say, we want our tax dollars to be used for our education and our health care and for mass transit systems and to save the planet that's dying, then they will change. Otherwise, why should they?
And what's the likelihood of that when people are preoccupied by their own troubles? When one looks at the news, one perceives the world as improving in terms of relations between governments, moving more towards democracies, the settling of great angers. What is to compel the people to move?
Well, because who owns the media? 23 corporations now own the U.S. media, whereas a few years ago 56 did. And who are they? NBC's owned by GE, one of the largest weapons manufacturers in the country, or indeed the world. And the corporations who own the media are involved intimately and deeply in the military-industrial complex. They're not about to teach you what is going on, because if you learnt, you would act against them.
So is this a box? Are we boxed in?
Yeah, you're brainwashed.
There are also people who say that such things as nuclear weapons have gone wild outside the hands of the major superpowers, and that the greatest threat is not from what you call an iron triangle or perhaps from the Soviets, but from third world countries, which will use them as they might use gases to hurt people, so-called less responsibly than we might.
You know, that's an enormous irony just there, because who has been totally irresponsible but this country in leading the arms race and filling the world up with nuclear weapons such that we have 60,000 hydrogen bombs in the world today, when 1,000 could induce nuclear winter and possibly the end of all life on Earth, and the Pentagon agree with that data. The Soviet Union has enormous numbers too of that 60,000, and both superpowers signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 68 saying that if the third world didn't get nuclear weapons, they promised they would start disarming bilaterally. They've done the opposite. So why shouldn't third world countries build nuclear weapons, I ask? I mean, they have every right and reason to if the superpowers behave as irresponsibly and as wickedly as they have. And sure, Iran could drop a bomb on Iraq or Israel on Egypt. That wouldn't blow up the world, except to say that almost certainly if that happened, the superpowers would become involved because of the early warning systems and the chaos that would imply, and then we would blow up the world. So that any small war in any third world, conventional or nuclear, could in fact these days initiate a global nuclear holocaust. So in fact war is obsolete. War is obsolete in Europe anyway, because Europe's filled up with nuclear reactors. If there was just one bomb exploded over Europe, all the reactors would melt down because of electromagnetic pulse, which would destroy all their computers and control systems and mechanisms, and Europe would be uninhabitable for the rest of time. Conventional war in Europe is obsolete because the reactors would be targeted, because in conventional war anything goes. So in truth, the splitting of the atom has changed everything except man's, and I stress man's, mode of thinking. Thus, we drift towards unparalleled catastrophe. And we do have a chance now. We do have a chance to save ourselves with that man Gorbachev. And I can't imagine anything more incredibly frustrating than for the world to look at that man Bush in the White House, who does not move. And you have to know he's got more intelligence than Reagan, but he does almost less. And I remember when Baker was having his Senate hearings, he said that they're waiting for Gorbachev to fail. And the Cold War is still on. Now, that mentality, in the light of the fact that the world is in danger of imminent extinction from, you know, even accidental nuclear war, I mean, I can't think of a term to describe that sort of wickedness.
Is your work, is your anti-nuclear work the seed that led to returning now to speak on environmental issues?
Well, it sort of is, in a way, because I came back to Australia in 1986 to recuperate from the work I did here, and I was really very burnt out, and I went to a beautiful part of the country in the south of New South Wales called Bermagui, where the beaches are pristine, pure, the oysters are totally non-polluted, just untouched. And I found out that the local council wanted to develop the coast, which means build suburbia and pollute it to death. And development equals pollution. Development isn't development. That's a euphemism for destruction. And so I testified before the council and I said, you know, the Northern Hemisphere is dying. And I realized that I had flown round and round and round the Northern Hemisphere talking to hundreds of thousands of people all over the world. And as I flew, I looked down and I saw it was dying. I saw the forest dying. I saw the lakes in Canada and knew that biologically they were dead from acid rain. I saw the pollution over all the major cities. I saw the forest dying in Europe. And I would see San Francisco Bay and it's like oil. I would look at rivers, beautiful rivers. The Susquehanna, I know, it was full of radiation. The Columbia River, the most radioactive in the States. But I didn't realize that I was working to save a world that was dying, and I suddenly understood that, and I felt really embarrassed and quite ashamed. And that is what moved me into realizing that both are synonymous, both are complementary. In other words, the money from the weapons, which is spent per year, which is $1 trillion, could be taken from death to be spent on saving the world, and within 10 years we would solve all the problems.
And that's the decade you talk about. You talked about 10 years to save the world from nuclear destruction in the late 70s.
And we've got that 10 point. Years. We've got to the point right now where we can. So my predictions were correct and accurate. The work we did in this country helped Gorbachev to do what he's doing. And so we have to take heart and say we're more than halfway there. All we have to do now is make that president of ours work with Gorbachev and sign an agreement to eliminate nuclear weapons within 10 years. No INF treaties or START treaties or the like. Elimination bilaterally in 10 years. The agreement that Ronald Reagan almost signed, the agreement that was lost that turned Schultz into a statesman.
Hmm. And would you merge the two movements? Is that what your thinking is?
The two are complementary and synonymous. Yeah. Yeah, the money from the weapons to be used to curb global overpopulation, save the ozone, prevent the greenhouse, build mass transit systems, stop the forests being chopped down, stop the pollution. Within 10 years, we'd save it. It's easy. I mean, it's so simple, it's simplistic, but you find that most brilliant solutions are simple.
I asked a question earlier, and I think I asked it wrong, but if we are complacent, if we are getting inaccurate information through the press, if we've those people who worked against nuclear war feel that a battle has been won, how are these people going to be reignited and charged, capable of doing such
Maybe
a huge
task? Maybe they should
task?
Talk to their children. The most intelligent people I ever talked to are young children in school. They know all of this and more. I don't have to teach them, they teach me. Mm-hmm. Because they have antennae out that they hear the news, they hear Gorbachev saying stuff. They hear Reagan talking his inanities. They hear Bush not liking broccoli. They know that the world can blow up tomorrow with an accidental nuclear war. They know the ozone's going. Without ozone, there can be no life. They know about global warming. They know about forests. They know about species extinction. Mm-hmm. And 75% of them don't believe they have a future. And for me as a mother and a pediatrician not to represent our children with my heart and soul, I couldn't look myself in the mirror in the morning, and this is why I do this work, for our children and for all of our fellow creatures on Earth who are being extinguished at the rate of 100 per day.
I noticed repeatedly in reading before we arrived here today references either about you or from you about the miracle of life. Mm-hmm. It is not so unusual as to be rare, but it is unusual to find someone who has lived for 50 years plus and who still wonders at the miracle of life. Where do you think this comes from in you?
I don't know if I agree with you, because I think if you've ever had a baby, the miracle of life is with you until you die, be you a man or a woman. If you've ever done biology and looked at a single cell under a microscope and understood cell biology, you understand the miracle of life. If you study the body and how it works and the intricate mechanisms that keep a person alive, it's absolute brilliance. I've just been to the Amazon. I went in a dugout canoe for 8 days down the Amazon. I wanted to see it while it was still there. To see one of those butterflies, you know, and to the beauty, and to imagine how many millions of years it took for that butterfly to evolve, and that. And then I've just done a course in scuba diving, and to go under the water and see the life there, the world of the sea and the fish and the brilliance of those fish. And that's evolution. How can you not be compelled by the brilliance and miracle of life and evolution?
Mm-hmm. You don't believe that many people on this planet become inured to the miracle?
No, not at a fundamental level. Mm-hmm. Because you see, I see them when they're dying. I see them when their children are dying. And I know that inside every human soul there's tremendous love and compassion. Mm-hmm. And everybody.
And is that what you would marshal?
That's force? What I do when I talk to my audiences. Yeah. They generally end up crying for good reason. Yeah.
And is that why you believe men or women more than men can do the work?
Well, men, I think, are probably even more sensitive than women, and so therefore they cover up more and they're more protected and defended. But, you know, then you have to look at women and say that 53% of us are women, and we have absolutely and ultimately no power. Well, we don't use our power. And don't, you know, Thatcher isn't a woman in my frame of reference. And that it's time that 53% of all parliaments of the world were composed of women. And that will be good women, bad women, right women, left women, the lot. But fundamentally, we're very much in touch with our nurturing instincts and with the life process. Well, we have periods, which indicates, you know, all the time we're in touch with ovulation and what makes life. And then we have a menopause, which is very painful too, which is rarely talked about. And I think those aspects of physiological mechanisms of a female make us more in touch with the life process, and therefore our legislation would be different, and that we would move faster and more practically speaking and more efficiently towards saving the earth, because we are very practical and very efficient and very intelligent.
You've recently gone into politics, or made a foray. You did not win the election in Australia, but came very close. What would you do? How do you envision your contribution to Parliament in Australia?
Oh, I people have been encouraging me to run for Parliament since I came back, and I've been saying, no, I'm not ready. And I decided 4 weeks before the election was announced the day before, to run, and that's how long the election takes in Australia. And I decided, because I was having lunch with a man from a newspaper, an editor, and he kept saying, well, we want you to run, we need more women, and I said no. And then we started talking about the US, and I said, you know, the US is static, and the rest of the world's moved far beyond it and left it behind. It's still pumping out 5 bombs a day, it still thinks the Cold War's on, nothing's moved. And he said, well, what can we do? What can Australia do? And I said, we've got to join New Zealand and become nuclear free and convince our addicted ally, the US, to get off its kick of nuclear weapons. And suddenly the light went on, the raison d'etre for me suddenly appeared, and I said, that's why I'll run. So I did run, and it was just amazing. My house was full of people from dawn till midnight, people I've never met, with a light in their eyes, and the campaign was so full of love and excitement and hope. It was like when I first founded Physicians for Social Responsibility. The enthusiasm was harnessed, and it wasn't because they loved me. It was because I represented their best hopes for the future, and at last he was a chance. We raised a lot of money, and we just missed out by a couple of hundred votes. We knocked off the guy who was to become the Deputy Prime Minister. It was a Conservative seat so safe that three families for three generations had held it. And it just absolutely upset the whole of politics in Australia. And I nearly held the balance of power with another independent in the lower house of parliament, so that the dollar fell, because the multinational corporations were scared that I might stop uranium mining, I might get the US bases removed from Australia, the military bases, I might stop military ships with nuclear weapons coming to our harbours, I might stop the Japanese chopping our forests down, and the like. And it was the two most exciting days of my life, I think, apart from the days when I had my babies.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell people who've joined us late, we're talking to Dr. Helen Caldicott, a longtime physician, a longtime worker in the anti-nuclear movement. Tell me, would you do all those things?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was just such a stupendous feeling. Instead of struggling around the world, carrying cases, talking to 1,000 here and 2,000 there, killing myself, to be in a position of such power that I could actually do it, you know. And therefore, I see three things that we have to do. We have to educate the public. We have to do civil rights things like Martin Luther King did and Gandhi. I mean, there's an incredible urgency now, because we've got 10 years to save the earth from global pollution. And we have to get into Congress and Parliament and become the politicians who are incorruptible, who take no money from corporations, who represent their constituents wholly and solely.
And to people who accuse you of just wanting power, you would say?
Well, I want power to fix things. I mean, when you're a physician, you have power over the patient, if used wisely, to save that patient's life. That's the sort of power I want.
Will you run again?
Yeah. I wasn't going to, But I got hooked at the end, and I thought, oh my God, what an incredible position to be in. Mm-hmm. And to want power for power's sake. Well, I've been there. I mean, you know, I know Reagan and I know Trudeau, and I know many of the film stars in the country, and I've walked the corridors of power, and it frankly gets to be boring unless you can use the power to help to save the planet. And I see the planet as a patient, and I see the power as a power physician has to save the patient.
What's the green movement like in Australia?
It's really quite potent and very sophisticated and had a very big impact on this election the other day. There's the Wilderness Society, the Australian Conservation Foundation, and they're politically very sophisticated, their data's excellent, and they do two things. They work politically lobbying politicians, they work in elections, and they are continually being arrested in the forest. And I've been arrested twice, once for lying under a car that was blocking access to the forest of trucks and bulldozers going in to chop down our last remaining wilderness areas. And you should know that our koalas are threatened now. They're on the edge of extinction. And in my electorate, when I was campaigning, they told me about a coupe of forest that was being cut down beside a highway where they were going to build shops to, quote, develop the area. And there were koalas and echidnas staggering across the highway that next day being hit by cars.
Because they're forced out of their habitat.
That's called development. We are producing the extinction of 100 species per day. Within 50 years, the tropical forests, if we don't stop, will all be gone, and within the tropical forests are one half of the world's species, of which there are 30 million. Mm. And I'm starting to think that the human being is far less important to the planet than our elephants, lions, tigers, whales, dolphins, butterflies, trees. And it would be maybe a good thing, and what I say now will many people find heretic. Might be a good thing if we actually left and let the world get on with evolution, because as we destroy ourselves, so we take everything with us. Someone said last night a brilliant thing. He said he's got a lot of hope, and I said, why? He said, it's a great time for paleontologists. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we can actually document our own extinction this time.
You have said we should limit ourselves to one child per family, worldwide, globally.
Well, we've got 5 billion now, and within 50 years we'll have 14 billion. We can't sustain the number we have now. And they say, well, it's okay in the first world, we can have babies. Each person here produces 20 to 100 times more pollution than a person in the third world, and soon 1 billion Chinese, 1 billion Indians will all want refrigerators and cars. Mm-hmm. Then the ozone is truly doomed. And the greenhouse effect is a certainty. So cars are obsolete. And who has to start getting rid of cars but we do? And we need mass transit systems, like, very badly. And you need to know that the auto companies and the oil companies and the rubber companies in the 30s bought up the mass transit systems in the major cities in this country and on purpose destroyed the trams and trains and the railways and filled the cities up with freeways full of millions of cars, and now we're drowning in our own pollution.
I want to direct you back to individual action again. The topic of the speech you're giving while you're in Fairbanks is environmentalism, global harmony, and citizen action. Can we talk about the citizen action part?
Mm-hmm.
What should the people of America be doing? Should we replicate Australia? Is Australia a leader in this movement?
I don't think any country is. I think, and every country is different. Certainly you're the most powerful country in the world still, despite Japan being the richest. And you have the greatest responsibility. So you must educate yourselves. Read Time magazine. I think the issue of November or December 1989 or 1988.
It's the one with the globe,
which had the
on
planet.
It, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an absolute classic. Mm-hmm. And it says the Earth is dying, and it is dying from three threats. One, the threat of global nuclear war. Two, global pollution. And three, overpopulation. Read that, and you'll have enough data to act. Then you've got to start looking at why you've all been so brainwashed, who runs your country, why your tax dollars aren't used for your health care, etc. And then you've got to make your own individual decisions about what you will do. but you need to dedicate your life now to saving the planet because this generation is making that decision right now. And I suppose I could use my own life as an example that I came into this country as an Australian and as a woman. And I said, we can get rid of nuclear weapons. And everyone said I was simplistic, naive, gullible, and stupid. And because I was all of those and more, I did help to launch an enormous movement here with millions of people wanting actually elimination of nuclear weapons or the arms race to stop, but ultimately elimination. And so if you decide to do something with your capabilities, and I'm good at public speaking, you can do that. And so I can't tell people what to do. You all have to make your own decisions. There is an organization for women listening called WAND, Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament.
I founded that,
and it's encouraging women to run for Congress. And I would encourage the women here to join that organization, Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament. I don't have the telephone number, but it is in Boston, Massachusetts, and the address is 691 Massachusetts Avenue, mm-hmm. Arlington, Massachusetts. As for what you really need to do, you really need to go back to your revolutionary beginnings and honour the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, and you need to run your country instead of the corporations running it. And I know you all know that you don't have freedom, because I ask huge audiences to put up their hands if they think they live in a free society, in a true democracy, and not one hand goes up, or maybe one. And I say, well, who runs your country then if you don't? And they say the corporations. So fundamentally, you all know that. But you have to do something about it, because it's the corporations who believe in perpetual growth and pollution to extinction, and they're using your tax dollars to do it. And you have to now decide that the government must represent you and not the corporations.
And do you have optimism that the
people
will do this?
Yeah, I'm tremendously optimistic. I think, well, I'm optimistic in that the mechanism to save the world is here. We spend $1 trillion a year on weapons, and I'm saying globally we do. 20% on nuclear, 80% on conventional. If you spend $1 million a day since Jesus was born, you wouldn't have spent $1 trillion. Now, that money transferred from death, which is weapons now. Weapons trade is the form of international commerce, not oil or gold, but weapons. If that money is spent $1 trillion a year for life and not for death, we can stop the overpopulation problem, educate women, provide mass birth control, feed the babies, immunize them, stop the forest being obliterated, clean up the air, stop the ozone destruction, build mass transit systems, and the like. It's easy, but people have to realize that they're not truly comfortable. And the reason they're not comfortable is that they're taking drugs, and one in two marriages are dissolving, and the kids feel desperate. And this is not a comfortable society. It's a very uncomfortable society. You've got to stop watching that bloody television, which is feeding garbage into your brains. It's feeding subliminal propaganda. Who owns the television but the multinationals who are polluting and destroying the earth? And you've got to maybe listen to NPR. You've got to start talking amongst yourselves and having fights in families and resolving them and having more human intercourse. And you have to do some critical thinking and some reading and thinking. Read the New York Times every day, cover to cover. And the data is there, the information is there that you need to decide what you're going to do to save the earth.
That is, you're truly promoting a revolution in this country.
Of course.
More so than if you said change the government.
Yeah. Without that, I believe the earth won't be saved, because Gorbachev will go in time, and then we've lost the opportunity to do it.
Your biography has, biographical articles have indicated that your childhood was very uneasy, that your mother was prone to bouts of rages, and that she battered you. A great many people who begin in those circumstances would have the self-esteem battered out of them, would have the curiosity and the courage and the willingness to explore on their own. And you have certainly explored on your own for a good many years. What was it that was different about Helen Caldicott?
Well, Mum, as well as hitting me, was also a very politically astute, wise woman, the most brilliant woman I ever knew. And I've just come through a difficult marriage, actually, and I tended through that to be codependent and blame my origins rather than looking at my present situation. And now that I'm out of it, I realize, in truth, I was blaming my mother for things that really I was in present trapped in a marriage which was not good for me. And so she was a brilliant woman, and she taught me a hell of a lot. And my father was a very humane man too. Yeah, they hit me, but they also had a lot of compassion for society and love, and for me too. And they taught me a hell of a lot. They didn't act themselves, but Mum knew in 1940 Hitler was killing the Jews. And she lived in Melbourne, Australia, and she used to have nightmares about it. And that was before even the Pope knew about it, I think, or certainly he wasn't acting on it. Mm-hmm. I would read, something would happen in the world and I'd become frightened, and I'd read Walter Lippmann and I'd read political commentators, and then I'd think, now what does Mum think? And I'd go and ask her. She'd have a vision that was totally different from the commentators, and she'd always prove to be right in the future. She talked about overpopulation 30 years ago. She talked about computers putting people out of jobs 20 years ago. And it's all come to pass.
Was she a great reader?
Is yeah, that where prolific it came for reader. Her? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And are you?
Yes, I've read enormously.
I suppose what I'm walking towards is, does it take, is passion the driving force for someone who would work to save the world, either from nuclear destruction or from environmental destruction? Is it passion? I mean, you're clearly vastly intelligent also.
Yeah, I think it's passion. I'm a very passionate person, and I think some of my passion has been sublimated in a certain sense, coming from a difficult marriage into this work. But also I'm passionately in love with nature. I've got a wonderful property now, 8 acres in Byron Bay, which is in a subtropical climate in
Australia.
New South Wales.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm going to plant a permaculture garden and mango trees, and I've got some rainforest there, and it's just, I mean, I'm never happier than when I'm out with my hands in the soil growing things, and I'm never happier than when I'm with patients helping them or making diagnoses. So I like to use my brain as well as being passionately in love with life. Yeah, I suppose it is passion.
What's a permaculture garden? I'm sorry.
Well, there's a guy called Bill Mollison who's this Australian. He's a lovely guy, and he developed permaculture whereby you don't use any chemicals at all, and you dig troughs around the garden in contours so that the rain doesn't fall down the hill into the creek, but it soaks into the land at all levels. And then you plant nitrogen fixing plants like sweet potatoes and other potatoes and legumes, and then you plant mangoes which take up the water and use the nutrients, and you use newspaper and straw to keep the weeds down so that you have a permanent mulch. Mm. And you keep the soil very fertile, and you may use it, and you use chicken shit. That's the main thing. So you have chickens running around, or else you import chicken shit and you use it all over the garden, and it's brilliant gardening, and it's, you know, the way we need to go in terms of organic and clean food.
So it's using and trapping everything that comes
yeah.
from nature.
That's right, and saving the land so there's no erosion, mm-hmm. and enriching the land as you go rather than depleting it.
Mm. You worried in an interview, or it sounded like a worry to me, that you had spent a number of the years early on in your movement work looking for love, looking for acceptance. Certainly you're not alone in this. I mean, half the world's people do in their efforts. And that you, when you went back to Australia, were going to make an effort to put that behind you so the work would be clean.
Mm.
Has that happened in Australia? And is this a reemergence that you feel is cleaning?
Yeah, well, my marriage of 26 years ended, which has been terribly traumatic. But through that time, that year and a half that's taken place since then, I've learnt a lot, and I'm becoming much more self-sufficient and growing a lot. And really, I suppose, learning to love myself. I always thought that that was sort of navel gazing and mental masturbation to love yourself. You know, I thought that was sort of pathetic. But in truth, appreciating myself, and then being able to appreciate other people, and instead of needing approval, and finding what other people's truth are to find my own truth and to know I have the truth for me and for the planet as I see it gives me an enormous amount of happiness and acceptance and power that I hadn't had before.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose they say you don't grow except through pain, and unfortunately that seems to be true for me. I have done anything but go through this time that I've been through, but I'm starting to feel really deep joy now, and really appreciating people probably more than I ever have before.
Because you're seeing them on new terms.
Yeah. And as I become more sure of myself, then I can be so much more accepting of other people.
Mm-hmm. And whether they do or not do as you wish them doesn't matter so much.
No, doesn't matter.
I wonder if something is still true. In an interview after your divorce, you said, or after the breakup of your marriage, you said, if I had known it would break up my marriage, I wouldn't have committed all the years to nuclear disarmament. Is that so?
No, it's not so now, yeah. As I come out of the pain and the grief. I think it was necessary for the marriage to break up, but in the last year and a half I would have done anything not to have had it happen. For 26 years I have got three wonderful children, and I felt commitment was the first and primary thing. If I have three children, I'm committed to be married for them till I die, and I don't believe in hedonism, running out and finding a different flavoured ice cream just because you're unhappy. And if you're unhappy, that's symptomatic of the fact you've got work to do. And I would have worked on that marriage till I died, and there was work to do, but if both parties are not committed to that, then it can't work. And so I have been freed, and I've been thrust out of the marital situation, and it's been painful, but I've learned an awful lot. So I never thought that I would be saying this to you even 6 months ago.
Yeah. Mm. So this is a growing realization.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you mentioned a bit ago, and I'm not sure if it lost the context, but passion redoubled. Is it partly because it is your own now? It is cleaner?
Yes, I think so. And that I feel that I don't have to please anyone but myself, and I can say exactly what my truth is.
Mm-hmm.
And if people don't like it, I don't really care, because I don't need approval anymore. And that gives me such a sense of joy, to be in touch with who I am. And you know, people want to call it God or whatever. I don't really need to give it a name. I just call it my truth. And we've all got that inside us, and it's just ecstatic when you get in touch with that. The answers are all there for each person, but they certainly are for me.
And what happened to help you get in touch besides the pain? What did you do?
Oh.
I'm wondering if it was just because it was quieter in your life.
No. Well, what happened, I don't want to go into too many intimate details, but that I was forced out of the house where I lived by an act of my husband coming to live actually with his new partner into a very small village where I lived. And I was sort of catapulted out of my nest of security that I'd created since he left. And I felt panic-stricken almost. I didn't know where to go. I felt like a refugee with no roots and no ties and nothing. And so I went up to this place, Byron Bay, for a weekend, and I thought, well, I'll live here, on an impulse. And I found a house and I fell in love with it. It's built like a Balinese temple. And I bought it within about 2 hours. And still, when I went back to Bermagui, my original place, to pack, I was still panic-stricken. But actually doing it and moving out, I felt a sense of euphoria that I'd never felt before. It was the first big major thing I'd ever done as an individual without my father or my husband making a decision for me or with me, and that I felt free. And when I got up there, I thought, now the past is gone and this is the future. No, this is the present and the future is yet to come. And so I felt liberated, and that, I suppose, I proved to myself by jumping off the precipice that that's the only way to find who you are. And by clinging to safety and security, you never grow that way.
You've talked a lot about, it seems to me, a lot about pain in the course of this last 40 minutes or so, and also in your writings. And I'm interested in the importance of it as a movement generator or empowerer. What I'm thinking of is early in Missile Envy, you said, you were talking about a couple of young gentlemen who were at the Moscow embassy at the time you were in Moscow, and they stopped and talked to you and the gentleman you were with great enthusiasm about the potential of nuclear and how we had to have these defense systems, and they gave you numbers and facts and figures, and you reflected on them and others of their ilk. Men like these who have never suffered any pain, any deprivation, starvation, or tragedy, and who have never allowed their emotional or moral reasoning to impinge on their rational and objective analyses. How important is it that people, connect all the parts of themselves, their emotions, their pain, as well as their intellect, to come to conclusions about what the world is, or what their individual world is?
I don't think you ever feel real joy unless you've hit rock bottom. You'd never understand how an Indian or a Nepalese feels starving to death unless you've been truly, really hungry. You'll never understand what it's like to feel cold unless you've been incredibly cold. In other words, you can't relate to people unless you've felt the pain. And I could use an example. I remember when my mother died, I became quite profoundly depressed, and an old woman came into my surgery, and she was deeply depressed, and her husband was hovering around not knowing what to do, and I said, "I know how you feel. You'd rather have cancer than feel like this, wouldn't you?" And she put her head on my shoulder and she wept and she said, "You're the first one who's understood." Now, I would not have understood that woman nor been a helpful physician to her had I not gone through that life experience myself. So you can't relate to people unless you've been through experiences of profound pain. I didn't come from an alcoholic family, but I came from a sort of dysfunctional one. So I've been to Al-Anon, and I think those 12-step programs are very useful. No one can help you but yourself, and you can't really decide to help yourself unless you've been to rock bottom or been in the gutter. And that's a sort of an analogy I'm using, or a metaphor for anything really, in a marriage or with the death of a child or something. And I wouldn't wish that on anyone, but you don't really understand the joy of the world unless you've really been to the bottom. And that's such an irony, and it's so sad in a way, and yet it's so exciting in another way. And you know, we have a long life, and we may as well experience all before the lid gets nailed on our coffin.
Mm-hmm. And is it that kind of integration that can fuel a movement, anti-nuclear or environmental or any other?
Well, I think often people who are in movements have had a lot of pain in their lives, and that's why sometimes movements are disparate and there's a lot of fighting and problem in a sort of new evolutionary movement or revolutionary movement, unfortunately.
It's kind of a dysfunctional...
Yeah, and often these sort of movements attract people who are on the fringes of sanity, because those who are on the fringes of sanity often have the greatest intuition and insights, whereas people who are terribly comfortable in their ruts don't have any insights at all. And so those people, although they don't tend to help the movement, see the truth in it. And if you work with schizophrenics, in fact, they're fascinating people, and they have revelations that none of us have, which are often actually true. I'm not saying that, they have some. Often their revelations are clearly loony. But the human mind's a fascinating thing.
Will you work as a physician again?
Well, now that I've lost the election, I've got to do something. I thought I'd coast along, but this brain of mine goes a bit nutty without anything to challenge it. So I may go back to medicine, practice part-time pediatrics until the next election, just for something to do. Mm-hmm. I also love the children. When you look into the face of a child, there's the world, there's the innocence, there's the honesty, there's the openness, and there's the beauty, and there's the reason why we live, really, isn't it? And then you can extrapolate that to a puppy or a kitten or a baby whale or a newborn plant just pushing its way through the earth's surface.
Mm-hmm. How long will you be speaking? This is a tour that you're on, is that right?
A month.
A month, and then home to Australia?
Yeah.
Where you think you'll practice?
Yes, I've got to come and do the commencement at Smith College on the 20th and get an honorary degree at Rutgers, and But mostly I'll be doing some speaking in Australia and working my electorate, I think, you know, educating them, taking them along with me, learning from them, getting to know the farmers, the cattlemen, the fishermen. Mm-hmm. I felt such a privilege when I was running to represent these people. It was like being a physician in charge of a hospital. Not that they're sick, but that the responsibility to represent them and their ideas was such a privilege. It's like I feel when I practice medicine, it's such a privilege to be told these things by people, they take you into their confidence, and mm-hmm. it's such a privilege. That's how I feel it would be to be a politician.
There is and you felt this, there's an awful downside of leadership. The your ouster, for example, from Physicians for Social Responsibility, by all reports, was due to the battle of physicians' egos in the in the organization at large. That I suppose what you have mentioned as dysfunctional fighting in past moments of this interview. You mentioned at the time or after that ouster that Carl Jung's suspicion that the leaders are always betrayed or crucified in one way or the other, mm-hmm. something like shooting the messenger for his or her bad news. Is leadership worth it? I suppose that's the question that I'm
Well, you don't. Wondering. Worth what? I mean, what are you doing it for? That's what's implicit in your question. You need to answer that.
If you're doing it for the movement, it's worth it whether you're going up or you're going down.
Well, you're not doing it for the movement. You're doing it for... I'm doing it. My goal is to save evolution. Mm-hmm. So worth what? I mean, anything's worth that, isn't it?
Yeah.
I used to feel during the height of the anti-nuclear movement that I would die to save the planet, that it would be worth it. But I felt I couldn't because I had three children and I couldn't disturb them by doing that. But I did have 8 death threats here, and I was glad to get out alive. But, you know, I do have to die sometime, not that I want to die prematurely at all, mm-hmm. but that to get a bit of disapproval, it was very painful for me. But so that's in the past. It doesn't matter at all. Anyway, the goal is what matters.
Right. So there is something of what King understood and what Gandhi understood in you, that the person is vital to share the information, the person is vital to spur or encourage the movement, but the person beyond that is not vital, right?
No, no. Yeah. No.
The movement itself is what is important.
Well, the movement's important, but the movement is only a means to an end, which is to ensure that this wondrous situation that we have on Earth, which may be the only one in the whole universe, in that we have life, mm-hmm. continues.
What do you see in your future besides politics?
Well, I'd like to find another mate if I could. That would be nice. I'm sort of battling with thinking, well, I have to get used to the fact I may live alone for the rest of my life, and I have to be happy doing that. So that's a big change for me. So I don't know what the future holds in personal terms, but it seems that I got so excited running for Parliament, and I think that that's what I'd like to do. I mean, that's what I'd really like to do for the rest of my life, be in politics, I think. And, you know, it's difficult because the press already had started to crucify me in the 2 days they thought that I held the balance of power. I said that there need to be international laws passed, that people can only have one child per family, like in China. And in Australia, we pay people to have children because we're underpopulated. And the press said that I was mad, and I'm not. But they take one line out of context from a speech where I've developed the argument clearly and logically and start to crucify me again. So I hadn't realized how tied up the press were with the party system and with politics and with personality of politicians, that they're part of that whole scheme. I thought that they did have a bit of distance and a bit of critical commentary, but no. And if someone comes in who's totally different as a politician and a woman to threaten the status quo, they themselves are threatened. And I was stunned by the reaction that they had to me. Rather, I thought they may welcome a new and fresh voice.
Well, it's been a very interesting time listening to your voice. Thank you for joining us today on Sunday at Noon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I'm Susan McGinnis. Hope the rest of your travels are good.
Thank you, Susan.
This is KUAC FM in Fairbanks, and this has been Sunday at Noon.